Like so many Americans, I've always loved Lincoln. I was introduced to him at my mother's knee. My mother, a trained teacher and a missionary wife, was also an elocutionist. And many of you here are old enough to know what an elocutionist is. It's a stage performer. My mother had memorized thousands of pages of short stories and readings and poetry, and was able to hold audiences in the palm of her hand. And I fell in love with the short story and poetry as her son. She homeschooled me for 14 of the first 16 years of my life, and there wasn't even a term for homeschooling back in those days. And I owe everything I am and everything I've ever accomplished, especially the 81 books now and counting, to her. And Mother adored the 16th president far above all others and passed on that love to me and my two siblings, Romaine, who is a concert artist that lives on the rim of the Copper Canyon in Mexico, and my sister that lives in Red Bluff, California. It was no small thanks to my mother that in college I majored in history, minored in religion, and English. I followed that up with a master's in history from Pacific Union College, a master's in English from Sacramento State University, and the PhD in English History of Ideas concentration from Vanderbilt University. And it was during that period that I wrote my doctoral dissertation on Zane Grey in the Old West. And some of you may not know that Zane Grey was a dental student here in the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And he didn't stay in it. His father said nobody could make a living writing. So, and then Grey was also in the University of Pennsylvania baseball team and played for the Orange Athletic Club in New Jersey. It's a fascinating story. As a result of my involvement in Zane Grey, I co-founded the society, and we have a group of, if any of you are into Zane Grey, we'd love to have you. We meet in fun places. We met in Williamsburg one year. We met in the Black Hills. We were in Provo, Utah last summer. This next summer, we're going to be in Durango. If you've ever wanted to take the Durango to Silverton train, we would love to have you with us. We're going to do that and stay in an old historic hotel in Durango, the Strader Hotel. All through the years of academic study, as well as teaching on the junior high, senior high, college and university and education levels, I continued to devour everything about Lincoln that I could find. Occasionally, I'd read my favorite stories in class, and my students much preferred stories to grammar, and they did everything they could to discourage me from having any more grammar than they had to have. Then came, looming up on the calendar of time, the 200th anniversary of Abraham Lincoln's birth in 1809 in a frontier cabin in Kentucky. Early on, I told my agent, he's my taskmaster in life, that on my personal bucket list of things to do before I died was a biography of Abraham Lincoln, as well as a companion book of stories about Abraham Lincoln. Finally, a contract was signed with Howard, Simon, and Schuster. Even though I'd been studying and reading Lincoln all my life, before I wrote the biography, I immersed myself in 60 more books on Lincoln, and many of them were biographies. Many of them were written by people that knew Lincoln personally. Quite candidly, I was really afraid of what I might find out about Lincoln. Since he's always been a patron saint of mine, and since the media and the writers of today go out of their way to divest him of all spiritual anything, I was afraid of what I might find. And even in areas in which it was a very clear spiritual thing that he did, such as make a vow in terms of the Emancipation Proclamation, they stripped that from their books. And so I was worried. And I, in fact, a number of people have already talked to me about I'm speaking now of Abraham Lincoln, a man of faith and courage, that many of you already have. How many of you do have that book already? Oh, well, good. I hope you brought it so that I can sign for a while. But it was after I had read I had written the whole manuscript for the book. And it was then that I said, thank you, Lord. I had confirmed what I had always thought was that Lincoln was a very spiritual man, and I was able to write that introductory chapter on his faith. Along the way, I had a different problem, and that are Christian leaders who not so slightly nudge me in the direction of saying things about Lincoln and the church that were not true. Because they figured that if I would risk my own neck and by not telling the truth, it wouldn't be any damage to them. But this is something that I definitely didn't do because I didn't want the book discredited. We discover in this book two women, both unassuming, dedicated, loving, and devout, made possible Abraham Lincoln as we know him. Nancy Hanks Lincoln, his mother, and Sarah Bush Johnson Lincoln, who became Abe's stepmother. They nurtured the boy quietly, moment by moment, patiently answering each of his questions as they came. They were never too busy to grant him the bullion of the universe. Time. As to the Bible, it held center stage in Thomas Lincoln's home, and it was the only textbook in those, what they called them, blab schools. Well, they called them blab schools for a good reason. They didn't have any textbooks. The Bible was the one that was usually used, just like it was the only book in many homes, and they all recited at once, hence the term blab school. And in his entire life, he probably didn't have more than one total year in any kind of school. He was entirely self-taught. But then came the New Salem years. I call it the Vanity Fair of Lincoln's life. Lincoln, ever the rationalist, was very uncertain about God, after, even though he grew up so immersed in Scripture that it said that he had memorized over half of the Bible. And this is why when you listen to his great speeches, such as the Gettysburg Address and the Second Inaugural and so on, you see the ring of the King James Version in the rhythm of what he wrote. And so, but he was very put off by the nasty attitude of denomination against denomination in his time in the frontier, in which they said really ugly things about each other. And he didn't feel that that reflected what he wanted to have in his own life. And it wasn't until the untimely death of his first child, Eddie, that, you know, in those days, pretty much any disease you got would take you. And women, of course, were dying in childbirth by the millions because no one up until Dr. Semmelweis in the late 1800s realized that the doctors and the midwives were carrying death from patient to patient to patients because they never washed their hands. And so that's why the average man up until the 20th century would go through two to three wives, because they would die in childbirth or childbirth complications. So it was a tough life on the frontier. And the death of Eddie, Lincoln was so impressed with the pastor, the Presbyterian pastor there in Springfield, that he became his spiritual mentor. And the story is in that biography of how that occurred. But then what really brought him to the Lord was being elected president. And, of course, even before that, during his debates with Douglas, he recognized as the nation was stumbling into catastrophe, that only God could see him through. And it's if you read his final address to the people of Springfield when he left, not knowing that he'd never come home, it's deeply moving as he recognizes that only with a higher power does he have any chance. And so if it's sad that all of these writers that ignore the spiritual dimension don't realize that without God, Lincoln would not be Lincoln. He would not have all these qualities that the world idealizes without his spiritual journey. And so this was something I wanted to do with this book. I prayed a lot as I wrote it. I wanted it to be a spiritual journey as well as just the story of his life. And I wanted the average person to feel, after reading it, that they really knew Lincoln. And I think my favorite Amazon review was written by a vice president at Focus on the Family. And she said, you know, I've always loved Lincoln. Every time I go to Washington, D.C., I go to the Lincoln Memorial and listen to people and think about the impact of this one man's life. But this time it was different. I just read Dr. Wheeler's book on his life. And when I went to Washington this time, I cried because I felt like I really knew the man. And that I just felt, I said, thank you, Lord, because that's what I tried to do with it. I also tried to make it unputdownable. I tried to have the quotations. He's the most quotable president we've ever had. Instead of lopping them all at the back, I did the hard part and I interwove them where the quotation fits in his life story. When Lincoln was asked why he didn't join a church, I found this very interesting. He said, I'm waiting to find a church that has as its sole creed what Christ's answer was in Matthew when he was asked, what do you have to do to have eternal life? And I'm sure all of you know that. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, thy mind, and thy soul, and thy neighbor as thyself. That's it. And I came back at this after I wrote Man of Faith and Courage. I was doing my second book for Thomas Nelson on St. Nicholas, because I've been so involved in Christmas with the Christmas in My Heart series. And that's the series that most people know me by. It's the longest running Christmas story series in America. Here's a copy of the latest one, 22 years later. And this is the one that Dr. Dobson did something to me. I remember that I got a call saying after the third book had come out, saying, are you sitting down? I said, no. The answer was, I think you'd better. Dr. Dobson has fallen in love with Christmas in My Heart and would like to use a story in there. A wonderful right-to-life story. And so I said, well, sure. And then can he read it on the air? And afterwards, a prediction that had been told me ahead of time, saying, if Dr. Dobson ever really uses you, your life will never be the same. Because by the time he sent 3 million copies of that story out that Christmas and read it on the air around the world, Joe Wheeler lost control of his life. And like I say, the 81 books has all happened because of, what I say is the Lord set me up. And if we had more time, I would share with you the sequences that booted me out of the classroom. I feel a kinship to C.S. Lewis, who said that the Lord dragged me kicking and screaming out of the classroom into a different ministry than I ever intended to have. And I told the young people this morning, because a number of them asked questions that had to do with pride. I thought that was interesting. Are you proud of what you've done? Is it exciting to be an author? What do you think about people reading your books and so on? And I told them that ego is one thing that is very dangerous for an author, because I feel very strongly that once a person is proud of self, God can no longer use that person. And I feel very strongly that the ministry that I have is the Lord's and it's not mine. It's just something that I'm able to go along with. I have about 50 plus personal letters from Dobson that I prize. And one of them kind of reflects this. And he said, "Joe, you're right. Neither of our ministries belong to us. But isn't it a great ride?" And it is a great ride to be a partner with the good Lord. I'm skipping some of this that I told you I would in order to have time to read the story. Story. The Creator hardwired us to be almost impervious to abstractions, but always receptive to stories. That is why Christ on earth never spoke without stories. It's safe to say that in a special sense, we become our favorite stories. And in this, as one of our books, it's I've done 31 books published by Focus on the Family along with that are part of the 81, and pretty much all the rest of them have been marketed by Focus. And one of them in Heart to Heart Stories for Moms, which is, it's really a dad story equally, is a story titled Billy Brad and the Big Lie. And for some strange reason, our kids fell in love with that story to the extent that they made life pretty tough, because no matter how many hundred times I'd read the thing, always the next day, "Daddy, read Billy Brad. And, well, what I discovered where children are concerned is that children find that yesterday is already to them gone. They never expect to see it again. Tomorrow is so far away it doesn't count. The only thing that counts to a child is today. And so consequently, if something was good yesterday, it's even better today. So this is why they loved their favorite stories. And then in the process, they become their favorite stories. Each time such a story is reread, the child internalizes more of the values that are in that particular story. It's so special to me tonight to be among so many fathers and sons. An all too rare sight today in a nation that has all but abandoned traditional family, traditional marriage. The media never passes up an opportunity to devalue or trash both families and marriages and traditional fatherhood. This reminds me, in one of the universities that I taught, I was standing in the doorway of the classroom one day, and it was a co-ed standing next to me, and there was a young mother walking down the hall with an adorable little boy in hand. And the co-ed next to me said, "Oh, I want one of those." And I made a kind of a wisecrack to her. I said, "Well, you have to have help." And he says, "Oh, once I had the boy, I'd dump him." And that seems to be sadly all too characteristic of our current hookup culture, which would scare me to death if I were raising a child today with what's happening. Let me give each of you fathers, most of you are younger than me, a word of advice. When our children were young, I was a workaholic dad, working 80-hour weeks, leaving the burden of child raising mostly to my wife, who did a good job, but raising a child needs both father and mother. And when I look back at it, even though I'm proud of our children now, I see where I paid a heavy price by being a workaholic. Our children are far closer to their mom than they are to me. And I had the opportunity to be there. And one of these days, I can tell you, if you haven't already faced it, you will look across the breakfast table at your wife. The kids are gone, and this is a time of life when some of you say, "Who are you?" after the kids are gone. But it's also a time when you begin to realize, oops, my time to make a difference in my child's life is over. And whatever you didn't do has a pretty tough fuse down the line. And so I want to encourage you to think of that. It's easy during the hectic years of childhood to assume there will always be time down the road to help instill in your children values worth living by. Then suddenly, it's too late. Children don't spell love L-O-V-E. They spell love T-I-M-E. They don't deep down yearn for things. They yearn for our time. Untold millions of fathers in America have surrendered the pulpit of their family to amoral, anti-Christian media preachers who tell stories to their children that are virtually guaranteed to destroy those children when they grow up. One day in the future, when our children are saying and doing awful things because we let the wrong preacher talk in our homes, we'll wring our hands and say, "I don't see where we could have gone wrong. We gave our children everything." But we didn't give them our time. We didn't give them a daily story hour in which day by day, by choosing the right kind of stories, we could be there to read, to hear, to discuss, to react to stories and books that would seep into their characters that each child was day by day developing. It wasn't that long in America that the center of home was the fireplace or the kitchen stove, the kitchen table. And they had libraries of well-loved books that you would gather together with, and you would read to each other, and you would read stories. And it is during the strangest times of a child's life that a unique thing occurs. A child will ask a question, quite often as a result of something that was in a story or something that was in a book. And you as a parent gulp. You realize your child is on dangerous ground, morally or ethically or otherwise. And you say, ooh. And you're able to do a course correction if you're there. But if by default you don't have those story hours and you entrust the moral growth of your child to people that are not Christian, who don't have a vested interest in how your child grows up, it's very sad things can occur. So that is a pragmatic reason to be there with the daily story hour. I spent 30 years gathering data before I wrote my 1993 book, Remote Controlled, on the impact of television on the home. Perhaps the most significant thing I gained from those 30 years was the realization that two things. Let's say that you are, or your child, is listening to live drama, listening to radio drama, being read to aloud, or reading a book. There are no two individuals that will create the same mental imagery, because each of us has, we think by connotation and association to everything we've ever done, anything we've ever read, anything we've ever seen. So given that's true, let me give an example. Let's say that Pastor Joe tells his congregation that God is like a father. Okay, let's say you're lucky enough to have a Christian father who is loving and kind to his wife, supportive to his children, and he personally walks the talk. And in that case, you would have an easy transferal. Your child is able to say, oh, God is like Dad. I think I could love him. I could respect him. But on the other hand, what if you have a father who is abusive, cruel, sadistic, into all kinds of substance abuse and beats up the mother and the children, and the pastor says God is like a father, and the person winces. Uh-uh. I can't love that kind of a person. And so that's a problem that you face when you deal with the issue of television, because if it's television and cinema and video, if one person or 1 billion watch it, every last person gets the same picture. They get the same picture because the receiver's mind has nothing to do with the creation of it. And what this means is that over time, if you are getting, as the norm today is no books, no magazines, no newspapers, no print in the house, to speak of, it's all media. The media center is the very center of the home, or house, I would call it. It's not a home. And so what happens then is that as this prefab imagery that the mind has nothing to do with stacks up in your brain, you come to the point where nothing in the mind is original. Nothing in the mind is original to that child and to that person. And that's why we're having this incredible plague of plagiarism today. Because if you don't have anything in your mind that's original anymore, you can't not cheat. And it's a huge problem across America. Well, there's another reason to be pragmatic about reading. This is one that I was really surprised by. Let's say you're a Fortune 500 CEO. And you have you want to find out which of your applicants would be the best for a good job. They have a test that they have developed to develop to analyze whether or not a person is creative or not. It's like a 5-step thing, and they want to see if you can take something from stage to stage to stage question wise and arrive at a conclusion. But in order to make it work, they sneakily leave out a step. Let's say you have A, B, C, D, and E. Well, they leave out, let's say, D. The reader has developed a part of the brain that scholars call the library, in which the brain talks to itself. And the reader comes to this abyss in which there is nothing between this and something they don't understand. And like a spider throwing out filaments, a reader can throw out synapses and can bridge the abyss and go on to the conclusion. The non-reader will get to this point and, like Bambi on ice, will stay there forever. They cannot bridge because they've never developed that part of the brain. And I'm sharing these illustrations to show that there are, above and beyond the moral and ethical reasons for reading, there is also the creativity aspect that is huge. In our 81 books and counting, 66 of them are story anthologies that I've partnered with God in breathing life into these books. But what breaks my heart today is that publishers today have the constancy of a rabbit where keeping a book in print is concerned. And a lot of our books are already out of print. And I had hoped that when I started this ministry of stories that we would gradually have more and more and more books to help parents who were developing a daily story hour in their homes. And so right now, one of the things are we're just trying to find ways of bringing these back. I still have most of them available. But still, they're not available in the bookstores. And by the way, I do have some cards with Pastor Trevor in case any of you are interested in I have a weekly blog, Wednesdays with Dr. Joe. I'd love to keep in contact with you. I also have once a month Dr. Joe's Book of the Month Club, because in my English classes through the years, I had my favorite books, and these students have come back into my life saying, well, you know, I miss your books, the books that you like most. Wouldn't you do it again? Well, I have, and have been doing this for some time. Another thing I do in the classroom was that every day, so they didn't have just my ugly mug to look at in the classroom, I put a quotation on the board. And many of them have told me, oh, I've collected your favorites through the years, but now there isn't any more. Why don't you do something about it? So a year and a half ago, I started tweeting my favorite quotation for the day. So if you're into quotations or life and reading, and all of our new books come in into the blog, I will certainly have my experience with the young people this morning will be one of the blogs when I get home. I was so impressed with them. And this brings me back to our newest anthology other than this one, The Christmas in My Heart. Some of you have been asking what I'm doing besides that. I have a new book, Angel Stories, that I just came out with. It's my second collection of angel stories, and they're Christian. They are masculine, just like the Bible stories of angels are. And then I have a next year, I do have one more, in a tenth in an animal story series that I have been going for 10 years, and that will bring that series to an end. And then next year, Joe Wheeler's Christmas Love Stories. I tend to get a Christmas romance, if I can, in the various Christmas books that I do. Abraham Lincoln Civil War Stories. This has been on my bucket list for years. I spent a lifetime searching these stories out. My mother is the one that first introduced me to Lincoln stories. There is no other book that's ever been published that has done what we did with this book, that has taken the stories written about Abraham Lincoln, not the stories that Lincoln told. And I found these stories very few in books that have been written during the last 150 years. A lot of them in old magazines. Some of these magazines are over 100 years old that I've been able to track down and find these stories. And then in certain, I get them in computerized form, typewritten. If you're old enough, you'll understand some other forms I get them in. Mimeographed. Remember those things? You get sticky stuff all over your fingers whenever you handle them. If you're even older, you'll remember spirit duplicating, and you get purple all over you every time you use that. I get those too. And then I even get handwritten stories. And all of these have fed into this book. And as I say often, in fact, when I have time, I have them in the inscriptions. I say that in this book, you will see the only servant president America has ever known that comes into focus. The man who was accessible to everyone. I take the reader through Lincoln's life chronologically through story, divided into the introduction, the frontier years, the Civil War, the early years, Civil War, the late years. To live on in the hearts is not to die. And then I have great poetry or great lyrics that I do. I start out with Edwin Markham's Lincoln Man of the People. And by the way, I think it's the greatest poem ever written about Lincoln. And when the Lincoln Memorial was dedicated, out of the thousands and thousands of poems that had been written about Lincoln, that was the only one they felt worthy of being read aloud at the dedication. And then I also had that great piece of music that's also a great poem, Once to Every Man and Nation, by James Russell Lowell, is in there. The Civil War marching song, 300,000 More. Then, of course, the Battle Hymn of the Republic, and O Captain, My Captain. A number of you have spoken to me today about how you like the historical pieces that I did in the first Lincoln book. And the reason I do that is because so few Americans know history anymore. And I felt that if I didn't write this period piece introducing you to each section, you wouldn't understand what I tried to say about that time period. So I did that for each section in this book. So I would love to hear from you. And since I do have some more cards that I'll give you before I leave here, because I'd love to hear from you and stay in contact through the years. Now, in terms of what story to read, I wanted to do a story, since there are a number of boys, three of them here in the front row, that you would like. And this is one of the earliest stories that my mother read to me, and it lit the fuse of a lifelong love for all things Lincoln. And as I leaf through this book, even though it's a little bit longer than some, it's the only one that I felt really shows you what I look for in stories. Something that will have a Velcro-ish ability to crawl into your heart and you can never get rid of it in life. I had marked it. Shows you how good I had marked it. A Lesson in Forgiveness by T. Morris Longstreth. In America's terrible Civil War, the punishment for desertion or sleeping on guard duty was death. No officer or court, no matter how high, could stop the firing squad. Only one person had the power, the president himself, the loneliest man in the country, it often seemed. The Ripley brothers were as different in nearly every way as are the rapids and still pools of a mountain stream. Perhaps that is why they loved each other in a way not usually meant by brotherly love. Will Ripley was the still pool. He was thoughtful to the point of appearing drowsy, honest as daylight, mild-tempered, and 20. He was up north in Pennsylvania somewhere, either dead or alive, for the date of this story is July 7, 1863, which means, as you can read in the dispatches of the time, that the terrible Battle of Gettysburg was just over. Another reason I had to read this story, because we're tying it to Gettysburg. The Ripleys on their farm near Washington had not heard from him for some time. Although Will was no soldier at heart, he had responded to Lincoln's call for more men 2 years before, leaving his young brother Dan at home to help his father and mother. Dan was now 14, a high-strung, impetuous, outspoken lad of quick actions and hasty decisions. He was the laughing rapid. But for all his hastiness, he had a head and a heart that could be appealed to, usually. The only thing which he could not reconcile himself was the separation from Will. Even Will's weekly letters, which had seldom missed coming until recently, and which always sent messages of love to Dan, coupled with encouragement to stay on the farm as the best way to aid the cause, scarcely kept him from running away and hunting up his brother. Dan knew that he and his collie, Jack, were needed to look after the sheep. But he knew that his father, who was more than a little invalid, must have help. But to see the soldiers marching set him wild to be off with them. In fact, Jack seemed to be the anchor which held him. Dan sometimes thought he loved Jack next to Will. The summer of 63 had been unbearably hot. There had been an increasingly ominous list of military disasters. Even the loyal were beginning to murmur against Lincoln's management of the war. Then Will's letters had ceased, and Mr. Ripley could get no satisfaction from headquarters. Dan was irritable with fatigue and his secret worry, his family nearly sick with the heat and the tension. And by the way, I should mention here that even the fictional stories in here, I have confirmed that, as far as I know, they're all based on true accounts. And this is true for this story as well. The climax to this date came from an unforeseen event. Jack, crazed either by the heat or by some secret taste for blood, ran amok one night, stampeded the steep, and did grievous damage. Father Ripley doubtless acted in what he considered the most merciful course by having Jack done away with and buried before Dan got back from an errand to the city. But to Dan, it seemed in the first agony of his broken heart, an unforgivable thing. Weariness, worry, and now this knife-sharp woe changed the boy into a heartsick being who flung himself on the fresh mound behind the barn and stayed there a whole day, despite the entreaties of his mother and the commands of his father. That evening, his mother carried some food out to him. He did not touch it. He would not talk to her. Sometime later, as the night wore on, he stole into the house, tied up some clothes in a bundle, took the food at hand, and crept out of his home. Once more, he went to the grave of his slain pal. What he said there, aloud but quietly, need not be told. Sufficient it is to know that a burning resentment toward his father filled him, coupled with a sickening longing to be with his brother Will. Ill with his hasty anger, he thought that Will was the only one in the world who loved or understood him. In the wee hours of the morning, he left the farm, forever, as he thought, and turned down the road which led to the soldiers' home. Some of you know about that. Not far away, where he hoped to find someone who could tell him how to get to Will's regiment. The sultry, starless heat of a Washington midsummer enclosed him. The wood was very dark and breathless. His head throbbed, but he pushed on. High-tempered, unforgiving, he would show them all. Suddenly he remembered that he had not said the Lord's Prayer that night. Dan had been reared strictly. He tried saying it walking, but that seemed sacrilegious. He knelt in the dark and tried. But when he got to, "As we forgive our debtors," he stopped, for he was an honest lad. This new gulf of mental distress was too much for him. It brought the tears. There in the dark by the roadside, Dan lay and bitterly cried himself into an exhausted sleep. At the same hour, another worn person, a tall, lean-faced man with eyes full of unspeakable sorrow, was pacing the chamber of the White House in the nearby city. The rebellion had reached its flood tide at Gettysburg 3 days before. The president had stayed the flood, bearing in tireless sympathy the weight of countless responsibilities. Now, all day long, decisions had borne down upon him, decisions that concern not only armies, but races, not only races, but principles of human welfare. He was grief-stricken still from his son Willie's death, who had died from the contaminated waters of the Potomac, in which there were no sewers, there were no bathrooms, and hundreds of thousands of men were polluting the river, and so there was no clean water near Washington. And his secretary, in the room downstairs, listening unconsciously to the steady march of steps overhead, read into them the pulse beats of human progress. Lincoln had given instructions that no one was to interrupt him. he was having one of his great heart battles. Finally, shortly before dawn, the footsteps stopped. The secretary's door opened and the gaunt gray face looked in. "Stoddard, do you want anything more from me tonight?" The secretary rose. "I want you in bed, Mr. Lincoln. Mrs. Lincoln should not have gone away. You're not fair with her or us." "Don't reproach me, Stoddard," said Lincoln kindly. "It had to be settled, and with God's help, it has been. Now I can sleep, but I must have a breath of air first." "There's nothing?" "Only the matter of the deserters, sir, and that can wait." The president passed his hands over his deep-lined face. "Only," he murmured. "Only. How wicked this war is. It leads us to consider lives by the dozen, by the bale, wholesale. How many in this batch, Stoddard?" The secretary turned some papers. 24, sir." "Yes, I remember Scanlon, in real life, Stanton, said that lenience to the few was injustice to the many. He is right, too." Lincoln held out his hand for the papers, then drew it back and looked up at Stoddard. "I can't decide," he said in a low voice. "Not now, Stoddard. You see a weak man. But I want to thresh this out a little longer. I must walk. These cases are killing me. I must get out." "Let me call an attendant, Mr. Lincoln. They're all asleep." "No, I'll take my chances with God. If anybody wants to kill me, he will do it." "You must go to bed, Stoddard." The two men, each concerned for the other, shook hands and good night, and Lincoln slipped out into the dark, his long legs bearing him rapidly northward. During the heat, he usually slept at the soldiers' home, being escorted thither by cavalry with sabers drawn. But he hated the noise of it, and during Mrs. Lincoln's absence was playing truant to her rules. When he neared the home, he felt slightly refreshed and turned into a wood road. The sky to his right began to lighten. By the time dawn showed the ruts in the road, Lincoln realized that he was tired. "Abe, Abe," he said half aloud, "they tell me you used to be great at splitting rails, and now a 5-mile stroll before breakfast. Well, well, what have we here?" The exclamation was occasioned by his nearly stepping on a lone youngster lying in the road. The boy raised his head from a small bundle of clothes. The tall man stooped with tenderness, saying, "Hello, sonny. So you got old Mother Earth to make your bed for you. How's the mattress?" Dan sat and rubbed his eyes. "What are you doing?" he asked. "I appear to be waking you and making a bad job of it," said Lincoln. "You didn't come to take me then?" exclaimed Dan, greatly relieved. "I wouldn't have gone," he added defiantly. Lincoln looked at him sharply, his interest aroused by the trace of tears in the boy's eyes and the bravado in his voice. "There's a misunderstanding here," said Lincoln, "almost as bad as a misunderstanding as Mammy and her mother had over Mr. Riggs, who was the undertaker back home." Here the gaunt man gave a preliminary chuckle. "You ever hear that story, sonny?" Dan shook his head, wondering how such a homely man could sound so likable. Lincoln seated himself on a fallen tree trunk. "Well, it was this way," and he told the story. Dan's quick, impetuous laugh might have disturbed the early rising birds. Lincoln joined in, and for an instant Dan completely forgot dead Jack and his deserted home. For the same fleet instant, Lincoln forgot his troubles in Dan's laugh. The boy chuckled again. "I'll have to tell that to He didn't finish the word, remembering with a pang that he was not going to see his father again. Lincoln caught the swift change on his face, and it was his turn to wonder. He knew better than to ask questions. "You can't fish for a boy's heart with question marks, neat little fish hooks," though they be. So he said, our sitting here when we ought to be getting back home reminds me of another story. Tell me, said Dan, well won already to this man, despite the gray lined cheeks and the sadness that colored his voice. Dan didn't know yet who he was. He had not seen the cartoons that flooded the country during election. He was too young to go in alone to the inauguration. And the very idea of the President of the United States sitting with him in the woods was too preposterous to even cross his mind. When Dan had laughed heartily over the second story, Lincoln said, well, sonny, I reckon we ought to be moving, don't you? He helped the lad with his bundle. Are you going to the war, too? Are you going to the war, too? Asked Dan. I am. You, exclaimed Lincoln. Why, you're no bigger than my own tadpole, and he's only a wriggler yet. Does your father know? I reckon he does by now, said the boy darkly. Father's an early riser. You see, he killed my dog without my knowing, and so I left without his knowing. The hardness of the boy's voice hurt Lincoln, who said, what's your father's name? William Ripley. That is senior. Will, that's junior. My brother is off in the war. I'm Dan. I'm going to find my brother. I don't care if I never come back. I love Jack better than... His voice choked. Lincoln put his hand on the boy's shoulder. He was getting the situation. Jack was your dog? Asked the big man, gently as a mother. Yes, and Father shouldn't have killed him, unbeknownst to me. I'll never forgive him for that. Never. Quite right, said the wise man walking with him. Don't you ever forgive him, Dan, or don't ever forget it, under one condition. What's that? Asked the boy, a trifle puzzled at the unexpected compliance of his elder with his own unforgiving mood. Why, that you also never forget all the kind and just things that your father has done for you. Why did he kill the dog, Dan? Well, he killed some sheep, said the boy. He would be honest with this tall, gentle, and grave person who understood so readily. How old are you, Dan? 14, going on 15. That's quite a heap, said Lincoln musingly, quite a heap. In 14 years, a father can pile up a lot of good deeds, but I suppose he's done a lot of mean ones to cancel them off, has he? No, admitted Dan. His frankness pleased the president. I congratulate you, Dan. You're honest. I want to be honest with you and tell you a story that isn't funny. For we're both in the same boat, as I size up this proposition. Yes, both in the same boat. I am in the army, in a way. At least I'm called commander-in-chief, and occasionally they let me meddle a little with things. Honest? Said Dan, opening his eyes very wide. He'd been so absorbed in his own disasters that he had accepted this strange, friendly acquaintance without question. But now, although the forefront of his consciousness was very active with the conversation, the misty background was trying to make him compare this man with a certain picture in the big family album, with another pasted on the dining room cupboard door. The same loose-hung person, only this one had a living rawness, maybe it was bigness, about him that the pictures didn't give, like a tree perhaps. But it couldn't be the president talking to him. If it was, what would the folks at home... And again his thought stopped. There would be no more folks at home for him. Honestly, Dan, but sometimes they don't like it when I do meddle. There's a case on now. Last night I pretty nearly had 24 men shot. Phew. But I hadn't quite decided. And that's the reason I came out here in God's own woods. And I'm glad I came, for you've helped me decide. I have, said Dan, astonished. To shoot them? No, not to. You showed me the case in a new light. Here you are deserting home, deserting your father, bringing sorrow to him and to your mother, who have sorrowed enough with Will and danger and all. You're punishing your father because he did one deed that he couldn't very well help, just as if he'd been mean all his life. And it's like that with my 24 deserters, Dan. Very much like that. They've served for years, faithfully. Then can any one thing they do be so gross, so enormously bad as to blot out all the rest, including probably a lifetime of decent living? I think not. I'll tell you what, Dan, and the tall man stopped in the road, a new light shining in his cavernous, sad eyes. I'll make a bargain with you. If you'll go home and forgive your father, I'll go home and forgive my 24 deserters. Is that a bargain? The boy had been shaken, but it was difficult to change all at once. It is hard to forgive, he murmured. Someday you'll find it hard not to, said the great man, putting out his huge palm for the boy to shake. Isn't that a pretty good bargain, Dan? By going home, by ceasing to be a deserter yourself, you will save the lives of 24 men. Won't you be merciful? God will remember and perhaps forgive you some trespass sometime, even as you forgive now. Something of last night's horror when he could not say that prayer, and something of the melting gentleness of the new friend before him. Touched the boy. He took Lincoln's hand, saying, "All right, that's a go." "Yes, a go home," smiled Lincoln. "I suppose I'll have to turn now." "Where is your home?" asked the boy, knowing yet wishing to hear the truth, to be very sure, for now he could tell the folks at home. "The White House," replied Lincoln, "but I wish I were going back to the farm with you." The boy heard him vaguely. His jaw was sagging. "Then you are the president?" Lincoln nodded, enjoying the boy's wonder. "And your servant, don't forget," added Lincoln. "You have been a help to me in a hard hour, Dan. General or no generals, I'll spare those men. Anytime I can do anything for you, drop in now that you know where to find me." The boy was still speechless with his assured elation. "But you'd better wait." Then Lincoln began hunting through his pockets. "You better let me give you a latchkey. The man at the door is a stubborn fellow, and for the folks will bother him. Here." And finding a card and a stub of pencil, he wrote, "Please admit Daniel Ripley on demand. A. Lincoln." "How's that?" "Thank you," said Dan proudly. "I reckon I should have guessed it was you, but those stories you told kind of put me off." "That's sometimes why I tell them." And Lincoln smiled again. "It's not a bad morning's work, 24 lives saved before breakfast. You and I ought to be able to eat a comfortable meal. Goodbye." And so they parted. The man strode back the way he had come. The boy stood looking, and then swiftly wheeled and sped. He had been talking to the president, to Abraham Lincoln, and hearing such talk as he had never heard before. But especially the words, "You have been a help to me in a hard time, Dan." Those words trod a regular path in his brain. He ran, eager to get to the very home he had been so eager to leave. Forgiveness was in his heart, but chiefly there was warm pride. He had been praised by Abraham Lincoln. Of this day he would talk to the end of his days. Dan did not know, though, that the major part of the day, the greatest in his life, was yet to come. Certainly the dawning of it had been very beautiful. Breathless and with eyes bright in anticipation of telling his tales, he leaped the fences, ran up the back door, and plunged into the house. The kitchen was quiet. A misgiving ran over him. Were they all out in search of him? Would he have to postpone his triumph? In the dining room, a half-eaten meal was cooling. He explored on, and coming out to the spacious front of the house, found them. Found them in an inexplicable group around a uniformed officer. Tears were streaming down his mother's cheeks. His father, still pale from his recent accident, looked ashen and shriveled. They turned at Dan's approach. He expected that this scene of anguish would turn to smiles upon his arrival. He was amazed to find that his return gave them the merest flurry of relief and alleviated their sorrow, not at all. "Danny, dear, where have you been?" asked his mother. "The Lord must have sent you home in answer to our prayers," said his father. Then they turned back to the officer, pleading, both talking at once, weeping. Dan felt hurt. Did his return, his forgiveness, mean so little to them? He might as well have gone on. Then he caught the officer's words. "Colonel Scott can do no more, madam. The president cannot see him. And more pardons are not to be hoped for." Mrs. Ripley turned and threw her arm across Dan's shoulders. "Danny, Danny, you are our only son now. Will was," and she broke down completely. "Will was found asleep on duty, Dan, and is to be shot?" asked the boy. "I wonder if he was one of the 24. They looked at him, not understanding. "The Lord has restored you to us. If we could only pray in sufficient faith, he could restore Will," said Father Ripley devoutly. "Dear, let us go in and pray. We should release this gentleman to his duty. We can talk to the father about it." Dan realized with a sudden clearness that his brother, his beloved, was to be taken from him as Jack had been taken. It shook his brain dizzy for a moment, but he knew he must hold on to his wits, must think. There was Abraham Lincoln, his friend. "You pray," he cried to his father shrilly, "and I'll run." "Run where, dear? Will is in Pennsylvania." "To the White House, mother. He said, any time I can do anything for you, drop in. Anything, mother, surely he'll..." "Who?" cried both his parents. "Why, the president, Mr. Lincoln." "But the president is busy, dear." "He'll see me, I know he will," said Dan. "Look, we have a secret together, the president and I have." And the boy showed his card and poured out his story. The mother saw a break in her gray heaven, saw the bright blue of hope. "We must go at once," she said. "Father, you're not able to come with us, but pray here for us." "Please take my horse and carriage," said the officer. "Yes," and said Dan, "let's hurry. Oh, I'm glad, I'm so glad." And the joy at his lucky turning back shone in his face as he helped his mother into the vehicle. "May God help you," said the officer. "He does," said the boy, thinking. It was high noon when the doorkeeper of the White House hardened into a very stony guard by the daily onslaught of Lincoln seekers, saw an impetuous youth leap from a light carriage and help a woman up the portico steps toward him. "In which room is the president?" asked Dan. "He's very busy," said the doorkeeper, probably for the 500th time that morning. "Have you an appointment?" "No, but he said I should drop in when I wanted to. And what's more, here's my latch key," said Dan, trembling a little with haste and pride, showed him the card A. Lincoln had written. The man looked quizzically at it and at him. "In that case," he said dryly, "you'd better step into the waiting room there." There must have been 40 or 50 people crowded into the anteroom, each on some urgent errand. Some were in uniform. All looked tired, impatient, important. Dan saw the situation and knew that Lincoln could never see them all. He whispered to his mother, showed her to a chair, then went up to the doorboy and asked if the president was in the next room. The boy admitted the fact, but would not admit anything further, including Dan. The annoyed looks on the faces of the waiting people deepened. "Does this urchin," said their looks, "expect to see the president today when so many more important persons, such as we, are kept waiting?" Dan, not caring for etiquette when his brother might be shot at any moment, slipped under the arm of the doorboy and bolted into the room. Lincoln was standing by the window. He looked around in surprise at the noise of Dan Ripley's entry. He recognized his walking partner, made a motion to the doorboy, who had one irate hand on Dan, to withdraw, and said, "Why, Dan, I'm glad to see you so soon. You're just in time to back me up. Let me introduce you to General Scanlon." Dan looked into the amazed and angry eyes of a Union general who, practically ignoring the boy, went on to say, Mr. President, I repeat that unless these men are made an example of, the army itself is in danger. Mercy to these 24 means cruelty to near a million. The president, warned not only from his sleepless night, but from the incessant strain of things, looked grave, for the general spoke the truth. He turned to Dan. Did you go home, Sonny? Dan nodded. Then I shall keep my half of the bargain, General. This boy and I each walked the woods half the night carrying similar troubles, trying to decide whether it was best to forgive. We decided it was best, as the Bible says, even to 70 times 7. Dan, how did your folks take it? Dan spoke quickly. It would have killed them if I'd run off for good, for they just got word that my brother Will, you know I told you about him, is to be shot for sleeping on watch. I just know he was tired out. He didn't go to sleep on purpose. I told my mother you wouldn't let him be shot if you knew. Lincoln groaned audibly and turned away to the window for a moment. The general snorted. I brought my mother in to see you too, said Dan, seeing as she wouldn't quite believe what I said about our agreement. Lincoln looked at the boy and his sunken eyes glistened. I agreed for 24 lives, he said, but I don't mind. I don't mind throwing in an extra one for you, Dan. And this time the general groaned. Stoddard added the president, will you see if there's a Will Ripley on file? The secretary left the room. Lincoln turned abruptly to the general. You have heard me, he said. I, with the help of God and this boy, threshed out this matter to its conclusion, and we only waste time to discuss it further. If I pardon these deserters, it is surely a better investment for the United States than if I had them shot. 24 live fighters in the ranks instead of that many corpses underground. There are too many weeping widows now. Don't ask me to add that number, for I won't do it. It was rarely that Lincoln was so stirred. There was a strained silence. Then the secretary entered with, Yes, sir. Our Will Ripley is to be executed tomorrow for sleeping on duty. The case was buried in the files. It should have been brought to you earlier. Better for the case to be buried than the boy, said the president. Give me the paper, Stoddard. Then you will, said Dan, trembling with joy. I don't believe that shooting the boy will do him any good, said Lincoln, as the pen traced the letters of his name beneath the message. Will Ripley is not to be shot until further orders from me. Dan looked at, Oh, thank you. He said, Can I bring Mother in to see it? And to see you, he asked. The president looked down into the shining face and could not refuse. In a moment, Dan's mother was in the room. She was all confused, and the general was red with irritation. She read the message. It didn't seem quite clear to her. Is that a pardon? Does that mean that he won't be shot? My dear madam, replied Lincoln kindly, evidently you're not acquainted with me. If your son never looks on death till orders come from me to shoot him, he will live to be a great deal older than anyone else. She stretched out both her hands, crying, I want to thank you, sir. Oh, thank you, thank you. Thank Dan here, said Lincoln. If he had not left the warmth of forgiveness soften his heart, Will Ripley would have died. And perhaps if I had not met him in the woods at dawn, I might have gone into eternity with the blood of those 24 men on my hands. Dan, help me. True, they are erring soldiers, Mrs. Ripley, but we must consider what they have done and what they will do as intently as we consider the wrong of the moment. Goodbye, Dan. We shall both remember today with easy consciences. The waiting crowd in the anteroom could not understand, of course, why that intruder of a boy who had fairly dragged the woman in to see the president so unceremoniously should bring her out on his arm with such conscious pride. They could not understand why the tears were rolling down her cheeks at the same time that a smile glorified her face. They did not see that the boy was walking on air, on light, but the dullest of them could see that he was radiant with a great happiness. And if they could have looked past him and pierced the door of the inner room with their wondering glances, they would have seen a reflection of Dan's joy still shining on the somber, deep-lined face of the man who had again indulged himself in mercy.